Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Accent On with Alona Europa, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, LA, and whole world, I hope. Also, New York. Today, Ilona Europa, your host, Monday, 6 to 7 p.m. on LA Talk Radio. We will be talking to my favorite guest, who has his own segment on Accent On. His name is...
Mike Gormley.
Hi, Mike.
Good evening.
I like this title, Accent On. Mike Gormley.
The accent on Gormley.
I will put Mike
the Gormley. Accent graph.
Okay, this is, we have really very unusual guest, and I'm just very happy to have you every first and third Monday mostly of the month, and the amount of people that you are bringing, obviously mostly they are mostly from entertainment business, but it's just a lovely, unusual history of music. They're bringing so much to the show that I'm very thankful for that.
Well, there are people that have been... Well, actually, we've had some new people in here. I mean, Ghana from Germany was in here a little while ago, and she's new to us anyway. And but a lot of the people are people who've been around for a while but are still very, very active and very creative in what they're doing. So it's not... Yeah, you can talk about the past, but we also talk about what's going on now. Today will be a little bit more about the past because it's a fellow who has written a book about hippies in 1967. The book is called In Search of the Lost Chord, 1967 and the Hippie Idea. And so we're going to explore what he means by that and some of the things that happened then. He was there. I was there. You were in Poland.
yes, 1960s. I was very young, but boy, this fad, I will call this a culture phenomenon, was really very strong in Eastern Europe too. And people maybe think, oh, it's all about America and maybe UK, but the music has no borders, we know it. And then story and the culture really came to Poland very strongly, and I remember being a little bit afraid of what I saw on the street. But we'll be talking about this more and more. Maybe we can unofficially introduce our guest. We'll be waiting for his phone call, and then we'll start all over.
He's calling us from New York, and it should be in a matter of about 2 minutes.
And his name is?
His name is Danny Goldberg, and he's written other books. He's been... on the forefront of a lot of sort of political activity, very liberal, but he's also managed artists like Nirvana and Bonnie Raitt and the Allman Brothers, and he presently manages Steve Earle, and you know, it's quite a varied background, and his some of his more political leanings. I'm looking for my notes here because I want to make sure it's right. He's on the board and was the president of the American Civil Liberties Union. Mm-hmm. He was. In the American Prospect and Americans for Peace Now, you know, so it's obviously not just music for him. He's very much involved in a lot of other aspects of our culture. He's actually at the moment executive vice president of the American Jewish Congress.
Wow.
And this is while he's writing books and managing musicians.
And you are saying the past, because the names that you mentioned are so big. And this is not what was. This is what it is right now. Also yeah. Very, very relevant, because young people are looking back into what maybe parents were growing up with.
Yeah.
And great music always will be great music. And most of artists that he was working with, they are really touring. They are doing much better than the youngest artists. That I think we have so much to learn from Mr. Danny. And we'll see what this interview will get us. Outside of that, Mike, what's going on in your life?
Busy, working with various artists, getting some things done. Kimberly Haynes' new record is doing very well.
She's got a lot of, I saw a video.
A lot of hits on the for the video. The song is "You're the One That I Want," that Olivia Newton-John had a hit with, and some of the money for proceeds are going to the
Olivia
Newton-John. Oh, hello. Hello, Danny. This is Ilona Europa, Accent on LA Talk Radio. Today in the studio, we have also Mike Gormley, who has his own segment on Accent On that we call Accent on Gormley. And what can I say? Very, very exciting guest. You are a very, very important guest to us. And I know Mike likes you so much. Mm-hmm. Then welcome to our show.
Thank you so much.
Hi, Danny. How are you?
Hi.
Haven't talked to you for a while, but I've read your book and enjoyed it very much. We were just talking about the book a little bit. And the book, again, is called In Search of the Lost Chord, 1967, and the Hippie Idea. Yeah, I like that you put in hippie idea. I always thought of it that way. It was an idea, but it was, of course, became much more than that. What about that era? What about hippies do we need to know these days? Maybe what is the lost chord?
Well, you know, the phrase I just kind of cooked up because I felt that the word hippie had become such a cartoon what people were reacting to when they heard it was something that just had so little relationship to what I remembered from being a teenager in the late 60s. Not that I was part of the things I write about, but I was just mesmerized by them. And so I just wanted to try to go back in time and figure out, well, what exactly was going on? I mean, to me, the innocent period of hippies before the media turned it into a cartoon was a spiritual movement of young people that for whatever reason didn't identify with the religion they were born into, but also rejected just the pure materialism that was the main American value system at the time. You see it like in that show Mad Men. And that's to me what it was. And then these external symbols here on guys playing around with gender roles or colorful shirts or things like that, those were just superficial things that were drained of meaning very quickly once the media kicked in.
And you also mentioned it was an energy, which I think is a very good word. I was in San Francisco in 65 and 66, and you'd walk down the street of that city at that time and you felt the energy and you felt what we might now call good vibes or whatever. You were in the city for a while, right?
No one knows why over the course of history certain places become a magnet for creativity at a given moment in time. There was a period earlier in the 20th century where Greenwich Village had that quality, and the periods when Paris had that quality. And somehow or other, San Francisco became a magnet for a lot of creativity, you know, and the Haight-Ashbury neighborhood in particular, you know, was originally attractive because the rents were very low. You had the Grateful Dead, the Jefferson Airplane, and Janis Joplin's group Big Brother, the Holding Company, all living in houses within a few blocks of each other. And you had the introduction of LSD to a lot of people around that time.
LSD and weed for the most part, I think, at that point.
So, you know, it just it became there was a sweetness there. I mean, I did a Q&A with a guy named Dennis McNally, who, you know, is a longtime Grateful Dead spokesperson, and who, you know, was involved with that movie that came out about them. And he said that, you know, the members of the Airplane of Dead that he had spoken to recently felt that 1966 was the real Summer of Love, because that was before Haight Ashbury had gotten publicity, when it was really a small community of a couple thousand people who were really unspoiled by the seductions of ego, press, money, or an influx of people too quickly. And by 67, the official Summer of Love, it was really basically that was the death of it in Haight Ashbury, because the influx of people and the media eliminated the vibe that attracted them there in the first place.
And that's understandable, because, as I said, I was there prior to... I actually left in 1967 for a couple of years, and then went back. It felt great in that city while I was there, anyway. What happened after the fact a little bit, we kind of, I think, ran into what you might call weekend hippies, people who weren't quite into it, but like the idea.
Exactly. No, it became the external symbols were you. In the earlier, my memory is, you could just look down the street and see somebody and just know that they were like a brother or sister, and you could trust them, and there was an implicit shared value system that felt pretty deep and tribal. And, you know, by the following year, those appearances meant nothing. Anybody could grow their hair long, whether it was Charles Manson or an FBI agent. So, you know, that just did change. But inwardly, I think a lot of people still tried to lived a lot of the rest of their lives based on whatever the values were that were happening at that time. Some did, some didn't. But, you know, I still think it was an interesting moment, because these ideas... Hello?
Hello? Hi. Yes, we're here. Can you hear me?
Oh, good. Sorry. Yes.
Oh, that's perfect. Mm-hmm. Okay, then maybe I will remind our listeners, we are talking to Danny Goldberg about his book, In Search of the Lost Chord. And this is so interesting what we are talking about. I know you hear my accent. I'm originally from Eastern Europe. I'm from Poland. Then I was a very, very young girl when all of these things that we are talking about, all the 60s, were happening in front of my eyes and my very scared parents' eyes. And fact is that Eastern Europe, even when was not part of this culture or movement, really on the street you saw something that I never saw before and after, the gathering of purity, of unusual group of young people who just carried guitars mostly with them, because our representation of the hippie movement was mostly through the music and through the Free Europe radio, which we were listening to everything what especially UK and America could offer to us. And this is how we learned the music and what was going in the world, not even mention Vietnam War, which obviously affected Polish people a lot too. And then there was very unusual period of time in Eastern Europe, or in my country. And I don't know if you ever visited.
I would love to hear more about it. It must have been amazing.
Yes.
Music.
Hello, we are losing you.
Into different places.
Excuse me, Danny, do you have a speaker, or do you have, are you talking on a speaker? Because we are losing you a little bit in and out.
No, I'm not on a speaker. I'm not on a speaker. I'm on a cell phone. I had said that, you know, that's all I would have available at this particular time. And I'm sorry if I'm going in
perfect.
And out of
that's
service.
Going, that's
going
perfect.
It's going fine. It's going fine.
That's going great. Okay, yes. Maybe one day we'll be talking more about the Eastern European feelings. But I'm telling you, what a amazing punch, or really, really strong emotional punch when it comes to music in my country, this period of time had on all of us.
Yeah. Well, it's just one of those things that, again, music somehow does cross borders and cultures in a way that other kinds of expression doesn't. I mean, the flip side of it was... you know, there were a lot of darkness happening at exactly the same time that this kind of utopian idealism was happening. I mean, the Vietnam War was raging, and You know, every 25 million young men were susceptible to the draft. A lot of them, you know, ended up dying, over 50,000 people. It was a time of tremendous racial tensions, as the expectations of the civil rights movement had given way to disappointment, and there were urban riots in the summer of 67 that was the worst since the Civil War. And it was a government that was not too happy about all of these protest movements. And we had a head of the FBI named J. Edgar Hoover who was worse than anything we've seen lately. So it's amazing that all of these things were kind of happening at the same time. And then in the middle of all of this, the Beatles, who were the most famous people in the world at that time, basically. You talk about music that traveled. I don't think anyone's music traveled more than the Beatles. Suddenly say that they're meditating, whatever meditating meant. It wasn't a word that anybody outside of universities or monasteries had ever heard, but suddenly it was like on every radio station and every magazine in the Western world. So it was a lot going on all at the same time.
How can you describe, this is very controversial to me. On one side, we have lots of blood, war, and political troubles in America. On another side, we have artists coming from England, from UK, singing "All I Needed Is Love." And we have these beautiful tunes that till this day, they are so, so important in our music. And music was, in a way, very commercial and not religious, but really very anthematic. And very beautiful spiritual, and serious, spiritual, you know. Where this came from, and really the open arms of America to allow these artists come here and just make them their own?
I don't know. I think these things just existed at the same time. You know, not everybody was against the war. I mean, the majority at that time was still for it, but there were a lot of people against it. And not everybody was so taken with this hippie pacifism and attempt to find what the Greeks called agape, universal love. But, you know, millions of people were. So the two things were kind of bouncing back and forth. But, you know, art tends to more be on the cutting edge, more progressive. And so music was very much the carrier of the positive side of it. And also the side that questioned governments.
Yep.
Because the same government that got us into Vietnam was putting people in jail for smoking dope.
Yep.
They still are. To some degree, they still are.
But I know your book is just very important to you and really to our parents, and hopefully everybody who would like to know more, probably this is like Bible, they can learn so, so much. But, you know, for me, the name of Danny Goldberg is just bigger than life, honestly. And you are a journalist, you are a book writer, and your name is so known in the music business. And I would like, Mike, if you can take maybe a moment and talk to Danny about his past as a really manager and very important name in this industry a little bit. Will this be okay?
Well, yeah, I first met Danny way back... must have been 69 or 70, and you were running Led Zeppelin's label. Would have been running, or maybe 71, 72, something like that?
Yeah, the job I got as publicist for Led Zeppelin was 73. And I kind of remember, I was a publicist earlier for kind of some record companies that were owned by Gulf and Western. And I remember you initially as a journalist, yes?
Right, Detroit Free Press and Chicago Sun-Times.
Yeah, Detroit Free Press, big contact, you know, major paper. So definitely someone to pay attention to. And then years later, you get into the business side and were the Bengals manager, which, you know, I just thought was one of the great accomplishments, you know, in the business. So I feel that you and I have been on some of the same pathways in this journey through music and media over these many decades.
Well, I see that, and here's the question I want to check out is in your path, you've had many incredible ups, but as a manager, I know you had to deal with some tough aspects, and I'm thinking of Mr. Cobain, Kurt Cobain, and Nirvana. What a great feeling of accomplishment, and then you have to deal with the dark side, if you will. I mean, I don't want to talk sort of behind your back too much, but I do believe you had to have one or more intervention with him and try to help him out of his troubles at that point.
Yeah, I was part of two interventions. The second of which was a week before he killed himself. I don't know that in a conversation like this I could bring all that much to it. You know, it's a very painful subject to me, as it would be for anybody who cared about someone or close to someone who killed himself. And I can only say I think he was the greatest talent I ever worked with. I felt that way when he was alive too. I worked with some really, really talented people, but this guy was unbelievable in terms of just the number of things he did at a very high level. He wrote the lyrics and the music. He was the lead singer and the lead guitar player. He designed the album covers. He storyboarded every one of the music videos. He designed the t-shirts. He completely, you know, controlled this thing. That doesn't mean the other people weren't talented. It was just that he was like one of those guys. And then on the other side, he was tormented, you know, by demons that, I don't know where they came from. And, you know, obviously it was from earlier in his life. And, ultimately they got him, you know. Yeah. I don't have anything really more that I could say.
I didn't mean to focus in on him. I didn't mean to put the spotlight on him so much. It's just the life of a manager is like that. It's got these great, great highs. And
oh, my goodness. Well, that's the only time anything like that ever happened, and I just pray it's the only time, you know, that it ever does. But there are ups and downs of being in the music business. You know, if you have a hit record, then, oh my goodness, everybody is so much nicer to you, and it's like you got 50 more IQ points, and you feel like a spring in your step. And then when you lose somebody, or they do badly, you just feel like it has been, and it's like over. So it's a roller coaster in that respect. But it's also I just consider myself so lucky that with no real academic ability, I did, virtually have no college education. I was a screw up in high school. That I found a business that would accept me and that I could grow in and make a decent living, you know, doing something that at least some of the time I love. I don't love every minute of it, but I love a piece of it, and that's a real, you know, that's really cool. So, but there's no question, your manager is, you're as good as your artist, and you're as good as your artists think you are. So it's definitely a lot outside of your control.
Just getting back to the hippie era and so on, I got a piece of music here that you talk about in the book. You talk about several pieces of music in the book, but this one jumped out at me because it became a kind of a theme, and it wasn't from a band that they were pretty big in that day, but they weren't commercially big, and that's Country Joe and the Fish. They had a kind of an anthem, and I thought maybe we could take a listen to it and due to its connection with your book. And the song is called "Fixin' to Die Rag." But it does start out with what they call the Fish Cheer, which was a high point of Woodstock, as a matter of fact. Can we take a listen to that, Iona?
Absolutely.
All right. Give me an F!
A!
Give me a U!
U!
Give me a C!
C!
Give me a K!
A!
What's that spell?
A!
What's that spell?
A!
What's that spell?
A!
Sam, need to help again. Self in a terrible jam, way down yonder in Vietnam. Put down your books, pick up a gun. Gonna have a whole lot of fun. And it's 1, 2, 3. What are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. Next stop is Vietnam. And it's 5, 6, 7. Open up the pearly gates. Go. Plenty good money to be made, supplying the army with the tools of the
trade. Jessup and Ray, they dropped the bomb. They drop it on the Viet Cong. And it's 1, 2, 3, what are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. The next stop is Vietnam. And it's 5, 6, 7, open up pearly gates. Yeah, there ain't no time to wonder why we're all gonna die. Here we go. Let's move fast. Your big chance come at last. Now you can't go out and get those reds. The only good commie is one that's dead. You know that peace can only be won when they bone them all a kingdom come. And that's 1, 2, 3. What are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. The next stop is Vietnam. And it's 5, 6, 7. Open up pearly gates. Yeah. Throughout the land, pack your boys off to Vietnam. Come on, fathers, don't hesitate. Send your daughters off before.
That's really, really a very, very.
Have you
cool
not heard
song.
That before?
I know. Of course I didn't, but I always question myself, will this song today will be relevant? Will people will go crazy for songs like that? What do you think, Mr. Denny?
Well, you know, it's funny. I just recently watched a miniseries on HBO called The Defiant Ones about Jimmy Iovine and Dr. Dre. And there's this whole section there about when NWA started and how confrontational they were, you know, with the government at that time, the police department, the FBI criticized them. And, you know, the courage it took to do that was really inspiring. But it took just as much courage in a different way for Country Joe to do that. Especially in terms of language and profanity, there were very, very few examples where you heard that word "fuck" on a record. I mean, I other than the Fugs, I don't even know if they used it. You know, and the unwavering contempt, you know, for the government of the United States. You know, that was out there. You know, that was and they never had a radio hit in the conventional sense of a pop radio hit. But because of the explosion of these underground FM radio stations that were just starting, and as Mike said, you know, the appearance of the song in the Woodstock movie, you know, they're part of the 60s. And they're one of my favorite bands to think about because they never became so pop. They're so kind of specific to the era in my mind.
They wrapped up the era to some degree. I mean, they were that San Francisco hippie band, so on. But not just that song, but many of his songs were definitely to the point in terms of protest.
Oh, the first album they made, that was, I believe, on their second Vanguard album. On the first album, which is called Electric Music for the Mind and Body, there's just so many wonderful songs to me. Now, I don't know what they would sound like to people that weren't teenagers when this record came out. But to be a teenager and to hear that record, you were hearing something very, very cool.
Very new and very dangerous, very controversial, really, and yeah, amazing.
I think in a way, what you were saying earlier about 66 really being the summer of love would be identified, that song versus one that did become a commercial hit in 1967 about... If you're going to San Francisco, wear flowers in your hair by Scott McKenzie. That was a commercial.
Yeah.
That was the total opposite of Country
that
Joe.
That was the total opposite. That was the exploitation song. It's fun. You know, I didn't have time to interview too many people for the book, but I did interview Lou Adler, who I'd never spoken to and I'd always been fascinated by. And because he and John Phillips produced that song. John Phillips of the Mamas and the Papas, who were a pretty big group then with hits like Monday Monday and California Dreamin', and they somehow had a hip aura about them, even though they had pop songs. They just dressed weird and they just carried themselves with this gleam in their eye that you thought they were somehow, you know, could be in the same room with the Beatles or something. And you know, it was considered a great exploitation and loathed by the San Francisco bands like the Dead and the Airplane. You know, San Francisco, it's why I was near here, and it was kind of a joke to them, but it became, you know, a song that makes people think of that time. It's in the Monterey Pop movie in particular, and you know, it's a sweet song. It's an L.A. pop mm-hmm. songwriter's idea of what the hippie thing was, but as we know, those L.A. pop songwriters could be pretty talented.
Well, it's got a great groove to it. I mean, the lyrics are, yeah, kind of silly, trite, and I know people from San Francisco who hate the song.
Oh, yeah. Well, there were such tensions. My goodness. Just learning about the Monterey Festival, I mean, it was so hard to convince the San Francisco band to be part of something that came from L.A., which was considered, like, so plastic and commercial and inauthentic, you know.
Yeah. I learned that from your book. I didn't realize there was that. I mean, a lot of these bands didn't sign on until a few weeks before the actual Monterey Festival event because of that. That was the reason?
Wow.
I think so. Yeah, I mean, they weren't making pop records. You know, the L.A. bands, the Byrds and the Mamas and the Papas and even the Doors had hit singles. You know, the Grateful mm-hmm. Dead and Quicksilver Messenger Service did not have hit singles. And neither did the Airplane on their first album. But when they added Grace Slick and put out the second album, Surrealistic Pillow, they then were the first band from that scene to have hits. But that was the anomaly. Most of these bands were, you know, were just mostly playing free concerts, a lot of time to audiences on acid with this kind of revolutionary stance. And they looked at the LA artists as being somehow corrupted. During you know, they very quickly all became friends with each other, and that tension dissipated, you know, but it was there at the beginning.
And it was also very interesting for nobody other than locally had heard about Janis Joplin at that mm-hmm. point. Otis Redding had never played to a white audience. Is that an exaggeration?
Yeah, Monterey was just, as far as I understand it, was, you know, there were a lot of history made there in terms of the American music culture. It's where Jimi Hendrix was really introduced to America. He played tiny little clubs in New York, not done particularly well. Goes to London, where he becomes a phenomenon, and people like the Beatles and Eric Clapton love him. It was Paul McCartney who suggested to Lou Adler that they have Jimi Hendrix at Monterey. You know, the guys in California hadn't heard of him. And so he becomes a superstar. Janis Joplin had, you know, was known in the Bay Area, and Big Brother had put out one indie record on a little label called Mainstream. But that's where Clive Davis signs her. She becomes managed by Albert Grossman, Bob Dylan's manager, and out of that comes the Cheap Thrills record. And Otis Redding had only been playing the so-called Chitlin Circuit in front of all black audiences. You know, he's a young guy with a couple of R&B hits, and he becomes, like, in some ways, the highlight to many people of the festival. Ravi Shankar, you know, people kind of knew that he'd played with George Harrison, but it was the first time he really, the Monterey Pop movie really put him on the pop stage in a new way. And then Eric Burdon, you know, the Animals, they'd been part of the British Invasion and had some hits like, you know, most notably House of the Rising Sun, their cover of the old blues song. And Eric Burdon just becomes completely psychedelicized as a result and goes on to have this totally different kind of career for the next 5 years.
Yeah, it's it was powerful in many, many ways.
Were you there?
Yes,
I wasn't at. Uh-huh. Oh no, I wasn't at Monterey. No, I was.
Yeah, me neither, man. I always, that to me, like, oh wow, if only I'd been at Monterey, you know.
Yeah,
it just always was the idealized peak that I missed, you know.
I miss Woodstock too, I have to admit, and I don't know how.
Oh, I was at Woodstock. It was nice. I was grateful to be there, you know.
Yeah.
Billboard sent me as the reviewer. So I actually went in a very comfortable way and had a hotel room.
Did you get on the helicopter? Did you get a helicopter ride?
No, I wasn't. Billboard, trade magazine writers didn't get on the helicopter. But I did go up there in a limo.
Yeah, you know, guys, you are talking about the 1960s and little 70s. This is the names that we are talking about in music. And just, I don't know how we compare 2017 with the era that we are talking about. Is this any comparison? Can we create stars like that, that that's our hearts and blood, everything is just loving them to death? And I don't know, something is right now too disposable, and artists come and go. We don't have a chance to fall in love with them, and then we need to look for somebody else. It's just something not right with music business. I don't know if you want to talk today about this, but what is your opinion, Danny?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, when somebody else comes along that's going to be very important, we are not going to be the first people to know about it, because we are too old to be the first people to know about it. The people that will know about it first will be teenagers, and they will tell the rest of us. So I believe teenagers are incredible. I mean, I have two kids in their 20s, and I'm very impressed with both of them. I think politically, the millennial generation is certainly the most progressive. They voted heavy numbers for Bernie Sanders, you know, and so on. And they're confronting issues that, you know, like global warming, that are unique. And they also have a comfort level with technology and a sense of possibility that is unique, and they're big. There are a lot of them, so I'm counting on them.
What do they listen to?
You know,
to?
It's going to come from them, not from us.
What style of music they're listening to? Are they really reaching out to the past that Dad is talking about in the books, and really they probably lived through some of your memories also? Or they really love what is right now on the radio? Or they are looking for an answer on YouTube, and they're searching for their own artists that maybe are not.
Yeah, I think it's more the latter. I mean, I think that the radio is probably less important than it was when I was young, because there were these alternatives that didn't exist when Mike and I were young, you know. And I think that it's very diverse. You have, you know, they're not all the same way we weren't all the same. But I think music is just very important to people when they're that age. It has a way of connecting with the brain. They don't even know why. Yeah. You know, it's like when they go, there's these movies of patients with dementia, and they play them a song from when they were young, and they suddenly come alive and start talking again. You know, so it's a mysterious thing. But I think the young people today, music's very important to them. And I don't understand a lot of it. I haven't tuned my ear to electronic dance music or hip hop. I wish I had in some ways, but just not what I just didn't. But I know it means a lot to my kids, you know, and I have a lot of confidence in the young generation. I think they've got some good basic attitudes.
Although you are still a manager, of course, big one, and you are president of Gold Village Entertainment, you have very unusual artists on your label, and one of them is controversial artist named Peaches. I knew her a little bit from Europe, somehow, somewhere.
Oh,
but
good. Yeah, she's lived so much of her career in Berlin, even though she's originally from Toronto.
Yeah.
And she still spends a lot of her time in Berlin, although she also spends a fair amount of time in Southern California. And she is so amazing.
So
I just
amazing.
Knew that that's who you were going to mention.
Yay! But the little hip-hop, you know, influences are there too. Very modern, very unusual, very, very cool artist. And just, we would love to play her music here.
You know, I've always been attracted to people that are special and have something to say. Some of them are more successful than others, but, you know, what gets me emotionally willing to make that commitment is usually people that are just brilliant. And she's as brilliant as anyone. I mean, she's so creative. She's so original. She does things her own way. She made like 10 videos on the last record. You know, she does theater. She, you know, goes years without making a record, and then she makes, you know, a record. And like I said, does all these videos. She's incredibly powerful on stage, you know, cutting edge in a lot of areas in terms of, you know, sexual expression.
Yep.
And it happens to be, I know I'm her manager, and maybe you don't, but she's so nice and thoughtful to work with. You know, it's an unusual combination.
Of course, we would love to have her on LA Talk Radio. If she's in LA, then we would love to play her music and talk about her.
Well,
career.
Mike has my email address, and I'll connect you with the woman in my company who deals with her day to day. His name is Cindy, and if it can be scheduled, I'm sure she'll do it. You know, I rest of the summer she's in Europe. That's for sure.
All right, fantastic. Well, We've covered a lot of different things, but there's an aspect of your life I find very interesting. It's not music, and I didn't know about it until I read about it somewhere many, many years ago in the 80s and so on. But there was a time you were chair and president of the American Civil Liberties Union, and you are still, I think, part of the American Jewish Congress. And that's a political life, I guess, is what you would call it. Is that
well? I tried over the years. I grew up, like we've discussed in the 60s, was, you know, certainly admired the anti-war movement and the civil rights movements. And then I got into the music business. But, you know, in the late 70s, I got inveigled into doing a documentary called No Nukes that Jackson Browne was involved in, and Bonnie Raitt and other people. And it was these concerts they did about the environmental hazards of nuclear power, and Springsteen, you know, was in it. And, you know, that made me realize that you could kind of combine working with entertainers and be kind of an activist for things you cared about politically, and that they didn't cancel each other out. They could reinforce each other. And, of course, living in Los Angeles at that time, there was this incredible example in the movie business of the way Jane Fonda and Tom Hayden reached out to so many actors and motivated them to get more politically involved. And you know, I just became part of that community somehow. And I was chair of the ACLU Foundation in Southern California when I lived in L.A., and I still believe that the ACLU is one of the great institutions in America that's playing a particularly important role lately, you know, with the threat and the deportations and travel ban and all that sort of thing.
Yeah. Well, it's excellent. Excellent work, and I don't know how you balance it all. You write books, you have a family, political
side. Well, it's over a 50-year period. I mean, you know, getting a hold allows you to put more things on your resume, as you know.
Well, that's true.
But, you know, I've always looked at, in the music business, I put that first if I have an obligation to a client or a job. But, you know, I found that sometimes there's some extra time to do these other things, and it makes life a little more interesting. I loved writing the book. It meant a lot to me. A good time in my life to look back and to try to give my version of what the 60s were. I hope people like it. You know, I just try to stay busy so I don't get too upset with myself, you know.
Oh, that's so cool. Don't get upset. That's so good. What next? Okay, you are president of Gold Village Entertainment. You also are personal manager, your record company president, public relations man, a journalist, book writer, and a politician in a way, and father, and I'm sure I know you have a beautiful wife. Then your life seems full. Then do you have some dreams that you think you didn't fulfill yet, as Great Vacation or something like that?
I just think one, I'm a very big believer in, you know, one day at a time. Appreciate the moment. Like you said, I had this little management company. I no longer run a record company. That was years ago, but I have this management company. I try to be there for my clients. I am going to keep writing, you know, and those are kind of the two things I'm most involved with. Publicly, and then privately, you know, that's my business.
Oh, okay. That's cool. And New York, yes, that's where you want to be. This is the place that you think is
correct.
your
based
home?
In New York. I love California, but New York is where I'm going to be based for a while. Anyway, I much appreciate being able to talk to both of you.
That's wonderful. We have one more song that, Mike, you prepared for us.
Yeah, I brought in another song a little bit later, more like 1970 or so. I brought it in, number one, because you went to school with this fellow, but also it was, I always thought it was one of the great pieces of poetry, really, and it may have had something to do with the whole rap and hip-hop world, and that is Gil Scott-Heron's The Revolution Will Not Be Televised. There are references into the song that don't make much sense right now, but I loved the piece of music, and I was surprised to read that you went to school with him. Did you work with him at all, or after school you went one way, he went the other?
No, I never worked with him. I would have loved to have worked with him, but, you know, by the time, you know, he had a career. He had other people he worked with. We weren't close friends after high school, but we were pretty friendly in high school. It was a small school. He was very popular, and he was very, very brilliant then. It wasn't clear that he was going to become the larger-than-life innovator that he became, but he was definitely the most talented person in our school. I mean, everybody, you know, knew that he was, you know, played instruments. He wrote fiction. He, you know, was a performer. He was funny. He was also a very good athlete, you know, relative to a private school in New York. You know, was on the basketball team, the football team. But his particular strength was writing. I mean, I remember he'd read these essays in English class, and it was mind-blowing. So then later on, I admired him, and, you know, he put out Revolution Will Not Be Televised, very much a product, I thought, of the kind of 60s culture, even though it came out, I think he wrote it in 69 or 70, you know, and by the time it came out, it might have been 70 or 71. But it was within a year or two after high school, he came out with this thing, and it's... you know, it still holds up. It's still used all the time. And yeah, I think Homeland used it as their theme song last season.
Yeah, I know. You hear it periodically. Well, we're going to take a listen to it as we head out. But thank you, Danny. The book is In Search of the Lost Chord, 1967, and the Hippie Idea. Danny Goldberg is the author. Very accomplished man. And I've always been pleased to say I know you and we're friends. And I hope that continues.
Oh, man, thank you so much for doing this. Thank you both for giving me all this attention. Much appreciated.
Absolutely. Anytime. Thank you so much for today, and good night to you. Good night to New York.
Right.
But for right now, we'll be playing the song, yes?
Right. Bye-bye. All right. Good night. Bye-bye.
Be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials because the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in four parts without commercial interruptions. The revolution will not show you pictures of Nixon blowing a bugle and leading a charge by John Mitchell, General Abrams, and Spiro Agnew to eat hog maws confiscated from a Harlem sanctuary. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by the Schaefer Award Theater and will not star Natalie Woods and Steve McQueen or Bullwinkle and Julia. The revolution will not give your mouth sex appeal. The revolution will not get rid of the nubs. The revolution will not make you look 5 pounds thinner because the revolution will not be televised, brother. There will be no pictures of you and Willie Mae pushing that shopping cart down the block on the dead run or trying to slide that color TV into a stolen ambulance. NBC will not be able to predict the winner at 8:32 on report from 29 districts. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of Whitney Young being run out of Harlem on a rail with a brand new process. There will be no slow motion or still life of Roy Wilkins strolling through Watts in a red, black, and green liberation jumpsuit that he has been saving for just the proper occasion. Acres, Beverly Hillbillies, and Hooterville Junction will no longer be so damn relevant, and women will not care if Dick finally got down with Jane on Search for Tomorrow, because black people will be in the street looking for a brighter day. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no highlights on the 11 o'clock news and no pictures of Harry R. Woman Liberationist and Jackie Onassis blowing her nose. The theme song will not be written by Jim Webb or Francis Scott Key, nor sung by Glenn Campbell, Tom Jones, Johnny Cash, Engelbert Humperdinck, or The Rare Earth. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be right back after a message about a white tornado, white lightning, or white people. You will not have to worry about a dove in your bedroom, the tiger in your tank, or the giant in your toilet bowl. The revolution will not go better with Coke. The revolution will not fight germs that may cause bad breath. The revolution will put you in the driver's seat. The revolution will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised. The revolution will be no rerun, brothers. The revolution will be live.
What an interesting hour, Mike. Wow.
Yeah, great inspiring kind of guy.
You are really lucky in that you met so many wonderful people. And what can I say? Staying power. I think we all have, in a way, staying power in the business. But this name is really, really big. What a guy. We were just talking, you know, how much he achieved already. And seems like he's in peace with what he's doing. And gosh, never stops. That's wonderful.
Right.
That's what we need to do in life. Never stop. But for right now, Accent On is over for today. And thank you so much for listening. And everybody who would like to listen again, please go to Elite Talk Radio to archive. Scroll down on Accent On page. This show will be available for downloads and listening anytime when people want, in 2 hours probably. For today, Mike Gormley, Ilona Europa, Accent On, LA Talk Radio. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to Accent On with Ilona Europa, right here on LA Talk Radio.